Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Happy Easter out there to anyone who's celebrating. Today, we're going to be celebrating Connecticut agriculture by bringing you clips from our recent visit to the state capitol for the annual Connecticut Agriculture Day celebration. Why is Connecticut grown so important? Well, stick around and hear the answer from representatives from the Association of Connecticut Agricultural Fairs, the UConn's Sea Grant Aquaculture Program, the regional USDA Rural Development Office, the Solid Ground Program up at UConn, Connecticut's Agricultural Commissioner Brian Hurlbut, and more. It's all for you here on this Easter morning installment of the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, and it's coming up right after this reminder. The efforts of Call Before You Dig, or CBYD, are being observed during National Safe Digging Month in April. You know, digging without knowing what's below the surface risks property damage, injury, and even death. That's why April is also Call Before You Dig Month, serving as a reminder of all the importance of safety when excavating. Be sure to notify CBYD 2 working days in advance to have the location of buried utility pipes and cables located and marked. And hey, it's the law, so submit your e-ticket. Go to CBYD.com or call 811 to avoid digging accidents.
Well, we are here in the rotunda area of the Connecticut State Capitol. Still a little construction going on, but also a lot of excitement here on Ag Day. And I've had the pleasure of bumping into Dustin Nelson. He's the past president of the Connecticut Nursery and Landscape Association. And he's here today to talk about collaboration to build workforce in the Connecticut agriculture industry. Dustin, as you were mentioning before we turned on the mic, the workforce shortage in the ag world here in Connecticut long preceded the COVID era.
Yes, and COVID only exacerbated it because people were at home, they were looking at their yards, they wanted to get outside and do something. So there was an increase in demand for that work. And we have highly skilled people in the industry who are growing plants. There's a huge demand for growers in this industry. And there is a huge demand for, you know, landscape designers and people to manage people. So then that way we can make these awesome landscapes happen, help beautify our state. So the Connecticut Nursery and Landscape Association is working heavily on workforce development to attract some of the great talent we have in our state here to this industry. So then that way they can not only, you know, work on the business end of things and, you know, be behind a desk part of the time, but also have the opportunity to get out in the field, work with people, work with the plants, you know, make a beautiful state for all that live here. And in Connecticut, agriculture is definitely a significant driver of the economy, and horticulture, which includes, you know, landscaping and plants, is over half of that.
And yes, the aesthetic end of the business versus the food end of the business, right?
Exactly. And it's not just a guy out on a lawnmower. It's not just a guy out working the field. There are great opportunities to make a career out of it. It's not something you just have to do while you're in high school or college, being a landscaper. We have people who have been with our particular company, Frank's Landscape Construction, for over 10 years. They are really highly skilled. They know the plants. They are able to make sure that the plants are successful in our customer's yard, so then they can enjoy it. And people are willing to pay money for good quality work. You know, there's some people that are always price conscious, and for whatever reason that they have, you know, that's understandable. But there's also people out there who want to, you know, have it be out of their hands. They want someone who is a professional to take care of it for them and create something that maybe they themselves didn't think of because they don't have the knowledge of the plant material that we have.
I know a lot of people who are rediscovering the joy of plantings around their own home or business. They want to be as responsible as possible, not just maybe going to a big box location and buying what looks pretty, but they want native plantings. And I just received probably about a week ago my updated guide to purchase native trees and plants and perennials, which I thought was a great addition to that guide. And, you know, I really have to give folks like you credit for the education end of the kind of the landscaping business.
And we are trying to be responsible stewards of the environment. And we are working with other organizations like the University of Connecticut on publications, driving people to where those native plants are available. We were one of the founding members of the Invasive Plants Council, and we currently work with that group to help evaluate the economic and the environmental impact of different plants so we can continue to be a responsible steward of the environment and make sure that we have a beautiful state for generations to come. And so by, you know, native plants are a great opportunity to work with the environment, but there are so many other great plants out there as long as we're avoiding those that have invasive tendencies. And so we're working with those different groups like the University of Connecticut to do the groundbreaking research on these different plants so we make sure we can, you know, because things are constantly evolving in the environment, and what was invasive or what's invasive today may have not been invasive 20 years ago.
So if you could help educate our listeners today, if they're out there and they're considering purchasing some plants or even some trees or shrubs for around their yard, are there a couple of types of tree, shrubs, or plants that you might want to steer people away from because they may be awesome to look at today, but a year, 5 years, 10 years down the road, they could be trouble?
And I'll make it easy for, you know, the non-plant people out there who are looking to dabble in it. When you're evaluating what to add to your landscape, if it is a quick-growing plant, that does have its benefits to gain you privacy, but at the same time, is it going to be something that gets out of control for your area? Is it going to be something that has lots of what they call propagules or creates lots of seedlings where it's going to overpopulate an area? And what may be invasive in one environment isn't invasive in another. So you really have to look at the different conditions in your area. And so if you work with an industry professional going to an independent garden center, they're going to have staff that have the knowledge that can guide you towards plants that are not going to be invasive in your particular environment.
Before we say farewell, can you just give a quick word about the impact and importance of soil testing?
Soil testing is extremely important because then you are not just applying on a hunch fertilizers. You have proven knowledge, you know, whether you send it to the University of Connecticut for testing, and they do have a small fee for their testing, or you send it to the Connecticut Agricultural Experiment Station, which offers free testing. They both are going to provide you a nutrient analysis of your soil and look at what fertilizers you truly need for the plants that you are growing, rather than just blindly applying and possibly causing runoff of nutrients, which then eventually make it into our waterways, causing problems with invasive plants on the aquatic level.
Right. So when it comes to starting a new or renewed gardening season around the home or your parcel, an educated consumer it makes the best gardens, I guess, right?
Yes, and there's fantastic resources out there, whether it's through the University of Connecticut Extension. A lot of the garden centers and landscapers are putting videos on social media So it's a great opportunity. There's so much valuable information out there, and just to absorb it and ask questions, and you know, we want you to be successful in the garden, because when you're successful, that means we've been successful.
Well, when it comes to education, I'm so glad we had the opportunity to let you kick it off. Thank you so much. Dustin Nelson is the past president of the Connecticut Nursery and Landscape Association. He's also affiliated with Frank's Landscape Construction. Thank you, Dustin.
Thank you very much.
All right. Well, the show would not be complete if we did not have another fellow Lithuanian on the program, but most importantly, that she represents the UConn College of Agriculture and Connecticut Sea Grant, and she's here at Ag Day at the Capitol today promoting Connecticut aquaculture. And regular folks that listen to me know I talk ad nauseum about Connecticut aquaculture as being such a critical component of the Connecticut agricultural network, and as the big posters on their display here at the Capitol today say, there's 30 million reasons why we should be talking about this, right, Tessa? Tessa is with us, Tessa Getches. Tessa, talk a little bit about your office and what you do out of UConn.
Sure. I work for Connecticut Sea Grant and UConn Extension, and we're here promoting aquaculture today. There are so many reasons to appreciate and value aquaculture. Just one of the reasons that we're here today to talk about jobs and the economy, but especially the fresh seafood that we produce in the state.
It's a big deal in Connecticut. Every time I tell people, you know, if you're eating oysters in Madrid, Spain, or you're eating oysters in, like, Sydney, Australia, they may be from the harbors of Connecticut.
They certainly may be. Connecticut's state shellfish is the oyster, so we're really proud of the farmers that produce them here. We also have a number of other species. We have clams and kelps, and we have farms inland that are growing farm-raised fish. They're growing marine ornamentals like corals, shrimp. So we have a lot of variety in our aquaculture industry.
Horseshoe crabs are in the news lately, strangely enough, but we're not reading those that much, are we?
Well, actually, we do have a company right now that's working in both Connecticut and Rhode Island to grow those species.
Okay, for consumption?
Not for consumption, for biomedical use.
Oh, I see.
And also for restoration.
Oh, okay. Well, what proportion of oysters across the global market are coming out of Connecticut, roughly?
Well, we are a top producing state, so we are probably in the top 10 in the country and definitely a world leader.
So one of the things you wanted to talk about today and expand a little more on is career potential. Aquaculture is among one of the fastest growing fields in the agricultural world, right?
It is. So aquaculture workforce development is really key. We are proud that we have 3 aquaculture-focused high schools in the state, and we also have several other VOAG centers. We have community colleges that are teaching the trades, electrical, plumbing, engineering. So we have really exciting opportunities to grow the industry here in Connecticut and support all of those surrounding sectors.
And frankly, for you moms and dads out there that are thinking, you know, the big tuna reality shows, it really is like, if your kid goes into aquaculture, it's almost like they're going on vacation every day, right?
It can feel like that. So it's a hard job. It's a 24/7 job, but it is certainly wonderful when you get to work out in that environment and produce a really nice product.
And as you pointed out, the future of aquaculture is expanding. You know, I always mention my pal Charlie Yarish and his work with the development of kelp as a consumable food around the world. That is really one of the hottest, newest expansion areas in your world, right?
It absolutely is. Dr. Yarish was a pioneer here in Connecticut, and now there are folks that are growing kelp and other seaweeds across the country and globally now. So there's huge momentum, not just for food, but a variety of other products that seaweeds are used for.
What are a couple of the other most important things that you try to impress upon people when they talk to you about, you know, what's the big deal about Connecticut aquaculture?
Well, aquaculture is really important, again, because it's providing fresh seafood, a great source of protein. But we also talk about the environmental benefits of aquaculture. So many of the species that we grow in Long Island Sound are filter feeders, all these shellfish. So they're actually improving the water quality as they feed on plankton. But aquaculture is very dependent on water, of course. And so what we do out in the environment, whether it's on land or in the sea, can really heavily impact aquaculture. So we try to engage people to talk about the importance of what they do on land and how that affects water quality.
And strangely enough, recently I ran into a gentleman from Watertown, Connecticut, who purchased a huge empty warehouse, and he's now farming fish out of that defunct manufacturing facility. Aquaculture has moved from the sea into some pretty big box buildings, right?
It's really exciting to see that growth. So Ideal Fish is one of those companies, and they're looking to expand now, and we hope we see more of that in Connecticut. It's an expensive type of operation that typically requires a lot of investment, but they can produce a lot of fish, and we want to make sure that that fish is available to the commons. So right now, a lot of the products that we grow in Connecticut are very high-value products. The future is really how do we feed the population? So we're really excited to get to that point.
But also, as you mentioned, the environmental stewardship goes hand in hand with the quality and nutrition that people are getting out of these aquaculture products.
Absolutely. And we have state agencies, public health, Department of Agriculture. We're constantly monitoring the water quality in these areas where animals and plants are being grown so that you can be sure that the seafood that you eat is fresh, safe, and delicious.
Yeah, so much like just, driving out to your closest farm stand and getting a bushel of corn or a bunch of carrots, you're going to your local dock or your local aquaculture purveyor, and they're selling you Connecticut-grown aquaculture products, and you know it's as good as farm to table.
It really is, and it's exciting, especially in our local restaurants now that are really promoting that farm to table aspect, and aquaculture is a big part of that.
And the consumers are happy to pay.
They're happy to pay. They're paying a lot more than they would be at the grocery store or for traditional fish products.
Yeah. But I guess you would share my sentiment when I say, folks, when you're in the big box at that freezer counter, look at the label and find out where that aquaculture product has come from.
Absolutely. Buy local. It's fresher and better.
Excellent. Great advice and a great chat with our guest this morning, Tessa Getchess. She's representing Connecticut Sea Grant and the UConn College of Agriculture here at Ag Day at the Connecticut Capitol. Tessa, great to meet you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a wonderful day.
All right. Well, the energy is already high here at the Connecticut State Capitol. It is Ag Day, Agriculture Day here in Hartford, and I am visiting with Kathleen Naples. She's with the Association of Connecticut Fairs, and I bet you didn't know that if you really, really wanted to get started early, you could actually head to one of our esteemed local granges to start your Connecticut Fair crawl as early as June, right, Kathleen?
That is correct. We start the season off in June, and then the second week in July kicks off with North Stonington Fair, and we're off and running right through the second weekend in October.
So if people really wanted to get deep into the whole Connecticut Ag Fair thing, where is that grange that really starts everything off?
Simsbury.
Oh, okay. Great.
And you can go to ctagfairs.org, connect to all of the fairs in Connecticut right there.
So, to the extent that you know some of the history, I mean, this tradition of agricultural fairs, you know, goes back pre-revolutionary times, right?
It does. In fact, I can't quote the entire history, but if you were to go out to the Brooklyn Fair website, there's quite a history. In fact, go to any of the fair websites and catch up on the history that dates back hundreds of years. It's a tradition.
Probably one of the awesome things that people can do but may not think of if they go to one of the many agricultural fairs here in Connecticut is that they may actually be interacting with or purchasing something from or seeing a display or an exhibit from a farm, a farmer or a farm family that may be third, fourth, fifth, sixth generation at that same ag fair, right?
Absolutely true. Whether it's apples, one of the orchards that are displaying there, dairy farms all across Connecticut, you'll find them at the fair. A lot of farms now have their own farm stores right at the farm. So no matter what you want, Connecticut's got it to offer. And you can visit those farmers right at the fairs as well.
And you brought up an interesting point. Are there certain fairs in certain parts of the state that tend to have more of a concentration of a certain type of farmer or a certain type of agricultural activity, or do they all kind of have the same boilerplate type of things, like judging for ribbons, 4-H, animal displays, and things like that?
Every fair has some kind of judging at some level. The Grange fairs, most of them do not have livestock. Cheshire Grange does have some animals. The Grange fairs tend to be, Cheshire is actually 2 days, but a lot of the Grange fairs are a one-day event. They tend to stick more to the preserves and the handwork. Once you get to your district major fairs, 4-H fairs, they all have judging of those items as well as livestock.
So I'm so old, I go back to the Danbury Fair days and have been to many, many of them, small and large. And I think that's the fascination. And I think we really could afford to have more people paying attention to this as some great thing to do on the weekends, really, from summer into almost Thanksgiving season. There are some small ones, as you said, but there are also some massive and very ambitious fairs that take up acres and acres of space, and they have carnival rides and car racing and animal pulling and horse competitions. Just amazing selection and variety of stuff.
Yes, the major fair, wherever you go, district fair, 4-H fair, has a wide range. Some may have more of something than another one, but every fair has something unique to them, and people are very focused on their local little twist on whatever that fair has. Some it's a skillet contest, skillet throwing, but the major fairs, actually major district 4-H, all have entertainment. Could be a main stage national act. It could be a local act. One is just as enjoyable as the other. And once you've got the animals, the entertainment, the carnivals, the food, because food is always a feature at all of these fairs.
Yeah, we haven't ventured into the crazy food inventions yet, but I guess if you could fry it, it's for sale at one of Connecticut's fairs, right?
Yes, it absolutely is. The food is always a main event. Some fairs, it's more of a local feature. Their church groups and local community groups are doing a lot of the food. Others, you've got those big, crazy concessions that they'll fry anything and you won't leave hungry.
Yeah. And speaking of community, to wrap things up, these fairs are also maybe one of the only opportunities in a very busy year of working on the farm when a lot of these farmers and agricultural folk get a chance to get together in one place with kind of a lighter atmosphere and network and learn things, right?
Absolutely. The fair for the farmer is much like a trade show. You're going there, you're exhibiting your animals, for instance, comparing your breeding with another farm's breeding. And that is a lot of the deep history and where fairs came about. I look back at some of those photos from maybe 100 or so years ago. There are more teams of oxen in those photos than we've ever seen. It's just an amazing thing.
Yeah, back in the days before tractors, there were barns full of them just to make sure the business got done, right?
That is absolutely right. How they even all got there, because you know back then they weren't getting on a big truck and trailer and going to the farm, and the numbers that would go. So these were very important events.
And in throwing out the challenge to anyone listening on any of our radio stations this morning to try to attempt a Connecticut Ag Fair crawl, it might be a little bit challenging because sometimes there's two or three of them on the same weekends. There's only so many weekends between July and the end of October, right?
Yes, there is. The last weekend in August is a huge weekend. We've got fairs lined up literally across the state that last weekend. Then that following weekend, of course, is Labor Day weekend. And again, there's several to choose from. So no matter where you are in Connecticut throughout the whole fair season, and fair season really is the best season here in Connecticut.
Yeah.
You've got a very good choice.
You can experience the seasons change from summer to fall at a Connecticut fair any weekend between July and the end of October. Kathleen Naples is with the Association of Connecticut Fairs. And if you want to plan your Connecticut Ag Fair crawl, you can go to
ctagfairs.org.
Very good. Well, Kathleen, thank you so much for stepping us off today here at Ag Day at the Capitol.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Hey, do you volunteer for or receive services from any of the hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations in our region? Or maybe you're just looking for ways to help. If your favorite nonprofit is hosting a fundraiser or community building activity, or you'd like to find a nonprofit to support in your neighborhood, just go to our radio station website, hit the events tab, and find one, or discover some of the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm John Voquette, your public affairs director here at Connoisseur Media, and we'll be back to the award-winning For the People, featuring the second half of clips and interviews from Connecticut Ag Day at the Connecticut State Capitol. Right after this, on May 1st, the Connecticut Commission on Human Rights and Opportunity, CHRO, in partnership with the United States Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, is hosting a Community Access and Equity Fair at the Connecticut State Armory in Hartford. The purpose of the Access Fair is to present the findings and recommendations of a statewide equity study, which examined programs and policies across 23 state agencies to identify inequalities in the outcomes for underserved communities and to make recommendations for improvements. Lunch is going to be provided at no charge, and transportation to and from the Access Fair is also going to be available in select cities across the state. If you'd like to learn more and link to register, just visit ct.gov/CHRO.
Thank you.
I'm good. Hey, Frank, how are you?
The busiest guy in the Capitol today is the Commissioner of Agriculture, Brian Hurlbut. Glad I was able to grab him for a few minutes after a quick break, let's just say. Commissioner,
good morning.
Great to talk to you. So, I know we only have a few minutes with you. What are the two most important things that you'd want everyone in Connecticut to know about Connecticut agriculture as it stands today under your watch?
Two most important things. That's a really hard question, especially when we have so much activity and so much positivity.
Let's talk about farmland preservation.
Last year, we had the best year in the history, the 45-year history of farmland preservation. We preserved 23 farm parcels, 1,560 acres, so 1,560 acres. We invested $10 million in real estate across the state, when you think about that. So what that means is that these farms are a little bit more viable. That land is protected for the next generation of farmers, and it helps them get started and continue in their process as a farm. Why that's important, we're highlighting this year at Ag Day our FFA students. So in order for us to have a viable agricultural economy in the future, we need to have viable ag lands available for these men and women to farm. So we're making the investment today for their future in agriculture.
Let's pick up on that thread. Not talking about next generation agriculture professionals, but first generation agriculture professionals. Your office is doing unbelievably good work in introducing new faces to farming, especially minorities, veterans. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Thank you for acknowledging that. That kind of doesn't always get raised to the top of our conversations with our media partners. We have been challenged by the governor. So think about what Connecticut will look like in 10 years and how our individual agencies are going to respond to that. And we know in agriculture, especially in a state like Connecticut, diversity is key. So we are focused on diversifying what we grow, where we grow it, how it's grown, and finally, who's growing it. So we're making a priority area in all of our grant programs to highlight veteran farmers, BIPOC farmers, which are Black, Indigenous, people of color, female farmers, and where it's grown. So not just in the rural communities, you know, in the traditional northwestern or eastern Connecticut.
Downtown.
We're in downtowns. We're in urban communities. We're highlighting and showcasing what agriculture can mean, not just to put food on your local table, but as a job and a career for those individuals.
Last question for those who say, how much could Connecticut agriculture really make for this state? It's such a small state. Let's have that number.
Yeah, it's a $4 billion, it's a billion with a B, $4 billion industry in the state of Connecticut. 22,000 jobs people work in agriculture. You know, 372,000 acres, and importantly, you know, we tend to think of Long Island Sound as a place for beaches and recreation. Mm. We've got 70,000, we've got oysters and clams, 70,000 of oyster beds down in Long Island Sound. So from the ground to the sound, we make it here. We've got a tremendous opportunity to grow on that you know, culture and history of agriculture. And today we're highlighting these students that are going to help us do it.
And I know I speak for Anthony, when I say, thank you for saying make it here.
It's important, and it fits with us, and that's what's important. It fits with agriculture, and we need to make sure that people connect. When we talk about making it here, agriculture is a part of that future success.
For four centuries.
For over four centuries.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank
Commissioner
you so
Brian
much.
Halbert, Connecticut Department of Agriculture, Ag Day here at the Capitol. Appreciate it, sir.
Thank you so much.
Well, we can't get to Ag Day at the Capitol here in Hartford without talking to somebody from USDA. And I'm really happy I ran into Lyndon Nichols. He's with the Rural Development Office, serving parts of Connecticut, Massachusetts, and
Rhode Island.
So we're standing here in front of some trade show displays showing what appear to be, you know, farmers in front of solar panels. And that's kind of been something that's been being talked about over the past few years, for good or ill. Tell us a little bit about the work that you do on behalf of folks in the agricultural world.
Sure. So we're under the Department of Agriculture because we work in rural communities. One of the programs that we are talking about today are our renewable energy efficiency loan and grant programs, which is available to ag producers as well as small businesses. We work in rural areas as far as the business side of it, but our ag producers are eligible in any area to apply for our loans or grants for developing renewable energy or for looking at different ways of efficiently improving their utilities.
So would you say, Lyndon, that the trend is more farmers looking for ways to reduce energy costs? Or is it more that they're looking for ways to develop alternate revenue by creating energy producing, for lack of a better term, you know, solar farms or solar installations on their property?
So I think it's a combination of both, because you want to be efficient in your energy use. They're also creating energy for their own use, not necessarily for sale. Mm. So they're decreasing their expenses and by producing their own energy. And also we do a lot with like digesters and solar and wind and all sorts of different alternative sources of energy. So,
In terms of the offset, are you finding amongst your clients and colleagues that the offset of creating your own energy versus buying it off the grid is making an economical difference and helping to keep farms alive?
Our customers seem to be very satisfied with the process. It seems to have improved their revenue flow. So, yes, I think it's a very successful program. It's assisted a lot of ag producers. And, you know, as we all know, farming is a difficult industry. So whatever we can do to make it sustainable, that's kind of our goal. Another program that we work with is our value-added grant, looking at alternative ways to produce, you know, like jam to grapes to jelly kind of a industry to kind of subsidize their revenues even further to make them more sustainable and keep agriculture alive in our states.
The other thing about keeping agriculture alive is keeping the ground under it and the air above it as clean as possible. You mentioned digesters as being one of the ways that farmers are looking to both create efficiencies as well as be a little bit more economically friendly. When people hear that term, what is that all about? What is a digester?
So what they do is they take the animal waste as well as they often will mix it in with food waste and produce energy with methane by breaking it down and producing the methane and therefore producing energy to go back into the grid.
So as homeowners may put a little a composting unit or a compost pile in their yard, farmers with large amounts of waste to do something with are getting into these digesters?
Exactly. So it's a good way to handle the waste, and it's also a good way to subsidize our energy issues.
Tell us a little bit more about this fantastic variety of grants that are available. Do you find that USDA and your colleagues are doing a good job connecting farmers who need it most to the dollars that make a difference?
I think so. I think we've been really fortunate. We've seen a large increase in the amount of grant funds available through our energy programs, and we've been able to take advantage of that to reach out and assist a lot of farmers across the three states that we represent. And then we also we work in all in rural areas in housing, business to provide job opportunities, communities for community facilities, and water, wastewater, other ways to improve the environment. So our goal is to provide every opportunity in a rural community that you'd get in an urban or a city setting. So we have 70 different loan and grant programs that we administer.
I also see two key words that both begin with V here in your literature, volunteers and veterans. Let's wrap up our chat today talking about volunteer opportunities with USDA and the great work that you're doing to help support our veterans.
Sure. So we're a sister agency under USDA. We're in a service center with the Farm Service Agency and Natural Resource Conservation. And under all of our programs, there are opportunities for volunteering as well as what's called a pathways. So if you want to be a paid intern while you're in school, you could possibly work with one of our agencies. And just go under usdajobs.gov, go in there, fill it out, and check off your interests, and they'll let you know when there are vacancies available. So
how about for our veterans?
The same. Veterans' preference in job opportunities is always considered.
Do you find that at least a uptrending number of folks getting into agriculture work as a first-time venture we're seeing more veterans getting involved?
Absolutely. There's a lot of initiatives like Arm to Farming and veteran programs in agriculture. We've had a lot of conferences that we attend and participate in for that specific reason, to get veterans more involved in agriculture. So there are a lot of initiatives out there. We also have a beginning farmer and rancher program across our agencies, as well as working with the states to provide opportunities for people that want to start agriculture or continue. If they've been 10 years or less, they're considered a beginning farmer, and we can assist them with a lot of our programs.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Lyndon Nichols is with the USDA Rural Development Office, covering Connecticut, parts of Massachusetts, and Rhode Island. And he's here today at Ag Day at the Connecticut Capitol, giving us the lowdown on the great work the USDA is doing across the board. Thank you, Lyndon.
All right. Thank you very much.
While the Lieutenant Governor works her magic in the front room here at the Connecticut Capitol. I'll tell you, if we were at our studios in Milford, we'd be calling our next guest our neighbor. But here we are converging in Hartford at the State Capitol. Just a couple weeks after we met up in Willimantic at a fantastic Meet the Farmer Fair. And Becca is all over the state right here today at the Ag Day. She's representing a program called Solid Ground. Becca, great to see you again. And we didn't really get to talk much in Willimantic beyond trying to get around the room there. But tell us a little bit about Solid Ground. It looks like a very, very comprehensive and exciting program.
Yeah, so Solid Ground is a program out of UConn Extension that specifically focuses on providing resources and training for new and beginning farm businesses. So that means individuals that have been farming for 10 years or less. And we provide them with all sorts of things at either free or low cost so that they can be prepared for whatever gets thrown at them in those first couple years of farming, which are usually the most challenging. So we offer things like free consultations in soil health and land access, consultations in pest management, because as you can imagine, a lot of farmers are dealing with that. And even working with urban farms throughout the state, as we're continuing to see a lot of new urban small-scale farms popping up in different regions around the area.
It was exciting to see your placard advertising that 3 out of 10 of Connecticut's newest farmers are first-time farmers, and your comment about urban farming hits right to the heart of it, because from the Commissioner Hurlburt down to the folks at Connecticut Food Share, we've been talking about the critical role that 20 or 30 one-acre plots versus a 30-acre plot up in northern Litchfield County can make to a food desert in an urban community.
Yeah, and that's even more important because in those small spaces, you're going to get more diversified crops. You're going to have more variety because they're trying to get the biggest output out of that space so that they can provide for their local community. And also out of urban farms, you see a lot more food that's grown that's relevant to the community.
Yeah, because, ethnically tailored to the audience and consumers.
Yeah, yeah, because they're part of that community. They know what the community wants so that they can provide things that may not be as readily available at the grocery store.
Maybe they're even taking that gardener aside and saying, when my grandmother grew that bok choy, she did this or she did that, and it came out so much better,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and that's the beauty with farming, especially in the smaller farming community. There's so much knowledge sharing, whether it be from other community members that you interact with or the farming community itself. A lot of our programming is in person because we want the farmers to know each other and share the information that they're learning on their farming journey together.
Right. I was also thrilled to see that Ag Mechanics is a part of the Solid Ground initiative, because without the best functioning and most economic equipment, you can't get that maximum output from this farm space that you may have. What is the Ag Mechanics program involved?
So we really, again, as a farmer and a small farm, you usually have to be a jack of all trades, take care of all of the things. and that means that when something breaks down or when something mechanical needs to be done, you're the one that has to do it because you may not have the funds available to hire someone to come and do it. So we've
They're just in the middle of it.
Exactly. So we've done things like two-stroke and four-stroke engine repair. So teaching people how to do basic repairs on like weed whackers, or even the four-stroke would be maybe like a log splitter or something like that.
Yep.
Things that our farmers are using on a regular basis. And then we'll go as far as like teaching them how to do chainsaw work. Because, you know, sometimes there's trees that need to be coming down so it doesn't fall down on you while you're farming. But then we also have things that are very practical in regards to irrigation. How to set up the best irrigation for your farm so that you're not wasting water, so that you're getting the right amount of fertilization, which can be done through irrigation directly to your plants, and really helping them survive and thrive. So
one of the other pillars of Solid Ground is agroecology. You mentioned pest control, but there's a lot more to it than just that, including no-till practices. That's really interesting. What's that all about?
So no-till practices, we're finding as science is, you know, exploring more in soil health, that there's so much benefit in leaving the soil untilled. So that means not turning it over with a plow every season. So that means that the microorganisms that are in the soil that ultimately benefit the plants that are growing out of the soil can live and thrive in that soil climate, as well as it also keeps carbon that is in the soil, instead of releasing it into the air, which we know releasing carbon in the air is a problem for all sorts of climate issues. So the no-till practices or low-till practices are what a lot of farmers are adapting onto their farms to keep nutrients in the soil, make sure their plants are healthier, and to also have a positive impact on the environment.
Do you find, or could you speak to the new farmers who are coming to the industry? Are these people who are leaving a career that is no longer fulfilling to them, or are you finding that there is a great deal of energy and interest in younger people coming out of school, coming out of military service, our BIPOC communities? How does that balance out in your view?
It is definitely a varied population. Actually, since COVID, I have seen an increase in folks that are retiring early and pivoting to owning a farm business and starting that part of their lives. But we have seen an increase in BIPOC farmers in the state, definitely people that are switching careers. I myself used to work at nonprofits and switched over to doing agriculture and working at a farm myself, as well as working at UConn Extension. Yeah. So there's a lot of people that are shifting into agriculture that don't have agriculture in their family background, so first-generation farmers. I will say it is a lot harder for younger folks to make that transition because it's hard in Connecticut. The cost of living is high.
Land.
Yeah, exactly. The cost of living is high in addition to the cost of land.
Yeah.
Whether it's the insurance or the even if you're leasing land,
sure.
It's so expensive.
Yeah, every facet has trended upward in terms of cost versus the amount that those farmers may be getting once they get to the output level where they're able to retail or wholesale the
yes.
crop they're trying to grow.
Yeah, and I think Connecticut is seeing a boom in people coming into the state from areas outside of New York City or Boston, and that land is kind of being bought up and turned into residential areas, and it takes decades to return farmland to that original farmland once it's been turned into a residential area. So, it's that competition that our new farmers, it's great that we have people in the state, but that's the main competition that our farmers have for being able to access land, is that people are coming in and buying up the land and outbidding our farmers, unfortunately. So whatever farms that we have, we want to make sure to support them.
Well, for those that are ready, willing, and able to get into agriculture, let them know how they can learn more about Solid Ground.
Yeah, well, you can definitely go to our website, solidground.ucon.extension.edu. And we have all of our programs on there that you can access. And you can also email me directly, rebecca.toms@ucon.edu. And we're here to provide you with resources that are, again, low cost or free of charge. If you are interested in starting a farm business, we want you to succeed, we want you to thrive, and we want you to be in our state.
And if the sound was a little iffy here today in the hall of the Capitol building, all you need to do is ask Google or Alexa or your favorite search engine to find Solid Ground at the UConn Extension or Rebecca Toms, T-O-M-S, and get in touch. They will get you on the road to farming and better farming right here in Connecticut. Becca, great to see you again. Thank you.
You too. Thanks so much.
Well, as we continue our journey through Ag Day here at the Capitol, we're pleased to make the acquaintance of Dom Pacini. He's with Connecticut Food Share. And I know that regular listeners have heard us talking to organizations that help feeding people, and we keep hearing more and more about the critical role that Connecticut farms and agriculture play in getting the freshest, best food to the audiences and the consumers who really need it most. And that's really what it's all about, right, Dom?
Correct, and you hit it right on the head. Our clients have really gotten spoiled dealing with the local farmers, because they're getting number ones, and everybody knows the food banks, we normally buy the number twos because those are the cheaper varieties that we can get year-round. But being able to deal with the local farms, they're getting stuff that's coming right out of the ground that morning, the next day, and it's just, it's made a huge difference with what they're getting.
Why rely on what came off of the big box shelves last night and arrived? Not to downplay that. They play a critical importance, but if you could get, like a bag of mangoes that traveled on a truck from a distribution center to a grocery store, sat on the shelf for a week, and then got brought to a Connecticut food share operation versus a truckload of broccoli that still has dirt on it from this morning, that's the way to go.
Correct, because and a lot of times when we get it from the farms, I have to let it cool off because it's got the heat built into it. Before I put it in the coolers to distribute,
We
have to let it cool down. Otherwise, it builds up too much condensation on it and everything else.
Yeah, that's how fresh it is, right?
Yeah, correct.
So you were giving me some pretty amazing numbers about how the volume has been growing on this program you're working on.
Yeah, with the LFPA.
What does that stand for?
Local Food Procurement Assistance. It's a program from the USDA and the Department of Agriculture in Connecticut. And we were granted some great money, and the first year we had it, we brought over 1 million pounds of local produce into the community. And last year, we actually brought in 1.4 million pounds of local produce. And it helped a lot of farmers because we had some farms were running into trouble because of the flooding. And the retailers that would buy from them were holding off buying from them because they didn't think they could keep up with their contract. So they came to us asking for help, and we were able to, with the funds, be able to buy and take care of them so that they can continue on. And
So to be perfectly frank, if it wasn't for Connecticut Food Share, there might be a few fewer farmers in Connecticut right now.
I don't know about a few fewer, but
at least maybe more distressed.
More in debt.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, that's great. Tell us a little bit more about how Connecticut Food Share is working hand-in-hand with agriculture producers to accomplish your overall goal of making sure anyone who's hungry in Connecticut is getting access to that best possible consumption products.
Over the last couple of years, we've increased our local farms to 90. So over the course of the last 2 years, we've been dealing with 90 farms. And it's not just the large 5,000-acre farms. 20% of our farms are the BIPOC farmers right now. So it's a pleasure to really try to help them and get them up and running and being able to move forward, finding land, because that's some of the biggest problems with finding land for some of the new emerging farmers. And it's been a great pleasure to see the advancements that they've been able to make with us.
In speaking with the Commissioner of Agriculture, Brian Hurlburt, this morning, that was another important point that he wanted to make was you can have 50 or 100 acres on a plot in northern Litchfield County, but you could also have 21-acre plots interdispersed throughout greater Bridgeport or greater Hartford. And essentially, all that's doing is getting that produce output closer to the folks who need it most faster, right?
Most definitely. It's direct to the consumer. A lot of our smaller farms, because of the quantity, we have them go direct to our pantries and soup kitchens, so they're getting the fresh stuff that same day that it's picked. So it's able to help their clientele and people in need.
And also building an audience and a customer base for a lot of folks once they get on their feet and they're able to give back to those local farmers as paying consumers, right?
Oh, most definitely, and they frequent their farm stands, and it's a big circle. And
it's also, quite importantly, putting a lot of the younger consumers in much closer proximity to the knowledge of where that food is coming from, not just the shelf in the store.
Oh, most definitely, because there's been some studies done that I've read that if you ask a child, where did this come from, they'll say from the shelf or from the box. They don't realize.
They'll say the store.
They don't realize where it was actually generated from. And
do you see a lot of hope for, the BIPOC and more urban farm audience playing an even more critical role in helping feed their hungry neighbors?
Oh, most definitely, because a good chunk of them are in the food deserts, and that's where we need the assistance the most right now. And if we can help them build their surplus up in those food deserts to get more nutritious food into that area, that's a win-win right around.
I'm laughing to myself because the big headlines last week were one of the big dollar store networks is closing, 1,000 pieces of property. Wouldn't it be incredible if all of the concrete and asphalt footprints of all of those closed dollar stores could turn into garden plots growing fruits and vegetables for our hungry people?
Not just regular traditional garden plots, but with the formation of hydroponics, a lot of the buildings we can put hydroponics into now.
You got the box with the power and the water and the story, right?
For sure.
Great. Well, super to talk to you. Don Pacini is with Connecticut Food Share, and you just heard why Connecticut Food Share is here today at Agriculture Day at the Connecticut Capitol. Great to meet you, Dom. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. You have a great day.
It's nice to talk the walk with somebody who is helping to connect Connecticut farms and farm and agricultural products to some of the youngest consumers to build a tradition of eating farm fresh. There is one person who is helping to do that with us here today at the Capitol at Connecticut Agriculture Day. Samantha Wilson is the New London School's Food Service Director and representing the School Nutrition Association of Connecticut. So pretty much the introduction says it all. It's like schools, nutrition, and farms. We could pretty much turn the microphone off right now, right?
Yeah, I mean, our job is to feed kids, and we want to do everything that we possibly can to do right by kids. We take a very whole child approach, and what that means is that there are a number of different things that you try to accomplish when you have kids in school. We want to make sure that they're well educated, well taken care of, and our part of that is that we want to make sure they're well fed.
Well, while I kid you a little bit, how are the school food services of today making kids eat their peas? I mean, let's talk about making farm fresh attractive and desirable to the ones who build their upper body strength, pushing the plate away.
Sure. So, I'm happy to talk about my district specifically in New London, that we are about 90% scratch cooking. So that means that all the products that we're bringing in are fresh whole food ingredients. So we're bringing in raw chicken and ground beef and lots of different products to create these meals. And on top of that, we're bringing in loads and loads and loads of fresh produce. So what that looks like is fresh cut melon, fresh cut pineapple, really beautiful Connecticut grown apples. We do a ton of salad bars and salads in our schools. So we get a lot of Connecticut local lettuce, really beautiful broccoli. And so what we're able to do in our program is purchase a lot of this food locally from farms within Connecticut, farms within a 20 or so mile radius of New London specifically, and bring it in and prepare it for our students. And what happens as the years go on is, at first, as we kind of transitioned our program, sure, students were like, I don't know that I want to try these carrots, or I don't like broccoli, I don't like salads. But before you know it, year after year, they start to try it, like it, and now it's just part of the regular meal. We offer a side Caesar salad every day as part of a student meal. So that's like the safe vegetable now, right? I mean, think about when we were in school. There was frozen peas. It was frozen carrots.
It all came out of the freezer.
Right. And now, they take a side Caesar salad and eat the heck out of it with their lunch. So it's been great.
I'm waiting for the guy that's going to make a million inventing the spotty apples are cool slogan, right?
Yeah.
But really, tell us a little bit about the acceptance of the fresh food and how your the creative team in front of the oven or behind the stove or at the cutting table is helping to make the food that we really want our kids to be eating all the time as accessible and kind of consumer friendly as possible.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that we do, whether it's maybe this beautiful fresh plate of broccoli that we've created or, you know, a simple salad, is we want to offer a wide variety of things so that if you don't like that option for the day, you're not going to just not eat any kind of fruit or vegetable. We have, you know, apple slices available for kiddos who are younger and maybe have loose teeth or they're not super familiar with some of the other fruits. We, you know, we have grapes and fresh cut melon and things that students are likely to take. Lots of really beautiful strawberries, things like that. And then again, on the vegetable side, we always have cold vegetable options. We have a vegetable crudité, we have a salad, and then a hot vegetable that goes with whatever the entree is. So you might see, you know, beautifully roasted carrots with barbecue chicken, or broccoli with our pasta dishes, or beans with, you know, enchiladas or something like that. So there's a variety. So little by little, we know, and we're not expecting to prepare 400 servings of broccoli and 400 to get eaten. We know that if we would rather make 100 servings of broccoli and see it go to the 400 kids and then see them try other things, because there's exposure. They're seeing it, they're learning about it, they're seeing their friends eat it, and maybe the next time they'll try it. But, you know, a really important thing for me is that we offer them a wide variety of things to just kind of meet them where they are.
Switching gears a little bit, there's a big difference between a big box truck just pulling up to the loading dock and hitting the dump button and 10 or 15 or 20 separate farm vehicles bringing maybe a pickup truck's worth of stuff to a school or a distribution location. How do you handle and what kind of team do you need to handle the logistics of all that?
You definitely need a lot of upfront planning, and we've learned that as the years have gone on, what works and what doesn't. You need very wide open communication with the farms to say, this is the type of product that I need, this is the quantity that I need it packed in, this is the way that I need it delivered, what is the delivery day, so we can build that into our operations. And then on the receiving end of it, we need to make sure that we have the equipment to take it in and store it. We have lots of containers that we can take it out of the boxes and the bags. And then, of course, we need the tools to prepare it, right? You need knives and cutting boards and skilled labor to prep all of these things. And so when you attack it from that holistic approach, you're able to put out the kind of product and the kind of variety that we're able to.
So am I hearing that you've actually got to the point where you're almost, in effect, commissioning parts of or entire farms to grow the most popular consumable agriculture products for your schools?
You know, that would be the loftiest goal that I would love to see us in another couple of years, but we're trying to get to that place. You know, hopefully there's increased funding available so that districts can do that, so that they can support the local farm instead of supporting, you know, the local large produce agriculture. But, you know, that's the goal. That's the goal, is to say these are the products that work really well for us. You know, we need to buy a lot of onions and broccoli and lettuces and potatoes and carrots. And these are the kinds of things that we will use all day, every day. And we would love for you to grow them for us.
Great. So New London is somewhat unique and organic, if you will, because you don't employ a food service to run your school cafeterias and take care of all the procurement and preparation and everything. Let's talk a little bit about how the association is bringing the work that you're doing to a growing number of statewide schools and school districts.
Well, I think, you know, we have a really active association in SNACT, and the goal is to share best practices and share it out with all of our colleagues, districts, whether they're self-op or management company. You know, the thing is, we all learn best by seeing what everyone else is doing. We don't necessarily want to sit here and reinvent the wheel in a silo on our own. And so we really try to employ this idea of partnership and sharing and coming to events like this to get the word out about all the great things that everyone's doing. And that way, people can take little tidbits of what's working in, you know, Groton and Norwalk and Stamford and all these different districts and, you know, put it in place for their kids.
Are you finding greater reception in the districts that have been tried and true food service clients?
What do you mean?
You know, the school districts that are not all self-contained versus like New London.
Right.
Do you find that those districts are getting with the fresh farm provider program?
Yeah, I think for sure. There's some districts doing a lot of really awesome work in the farm-to-school space and their programs in general who are also managed by management companies. You know, there's farmers markets that they hold in their schools, and there's relationships that they have with various farms. And so I think, you know, we have this great Connecticut collective of supporters in Snacked and Put Local on Your Tray and these organizations that are here for all of Connecticut's kids, self-op, management company, things like that. And then everyone is just, you know, doing what they can.
Do you find with schools that may not be really involved with farm-to-school programs that the parents and caregivers are the biggest driver into creating that relationship or making it happen?
I think so. I think it's a multifaceted approach, but ultimately it's important for you as a parent or a caregiver of a child to advocate for what you want to see you know, for your kid in your district. I am a mom of a young kindergartner, and so I like to advocate for him and the things that, you know, we want to see in his school.
That's great. Working hard to get Connecticut farm products onto the trays and plates and bowls of your kids' school. I'm talking with Samantha Wilson. She's the food service director at the New London School System, but also here today at Ag Day at the Capitol in Hartford, representing the School Nutrition Association of Connecticut. Samantha, really great to meet you. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. I appreciate talking to you.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program for the people. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.